These are African rhythms passed down to us through ancient spirits.
From WSNC 90.5 FM, a broadcasting service and NPR affiliate of Winston-Salem State University, welcome to Africa World Now Project. I'm your host and producer, James Pope. Today, Rethinking Reconstruction with Dr. Greg Carr. Africa World Now Project is next. Get off. Reconstruction, the period so named after the U.S. Civil War, is a period that in its totality is a clear articulation of the lasting implications of settler colonialism. Take the conceptualization of Reconstruction itself. This concept implies an implicit notion of equality, collectivism, cooperation, rebuilding, togetherness, democracy, so on and so forth. However, W.E.B. Du Bois, writing in a chapter entitled Propaganda of History, in his seminal work Black Reconstruction, argues that the facts of American history have in the last half century been falsified because the nation was ashamed. The South was ashamed because it fought to perpetuate human slavery. The North was ashamed because it had to call in the black men to save the Union, abolish slavery, and establish democracy. What are American children taught today about Reconstruction? An American youth attending college today would learn from current textbooks of history that the Constitution recognized slavery, that the chance of getting rid of slavery by peaceful methods was ruined by the abolitionists, that after the period of Andrew Jackson, the two sections of the United States had become fully conscious of their conflicting interests, two irreconcilable forms of civilization, with the democratic in the South, a more stationary and aristocratic civilization. That student would read that Harriet Beecher Stowe brought on the Civil War, that the assault on Charles Sumner was due to his coarse invective against a South Carolina senator, and that Negroes were the only people to achieve emancipation with no effort on their part, that Reconstruction was a disgraceful attempt to subject white people to ignorant Negro rule. In other words, that student would, in all probability, complete their education without any idea of the part which the black race has played in America, of the tremendous moral problem of abolition, of the cause and meaning of the Civil War, and the relation which Reconstruction had to democratic government and the labor movement today. War, and especially civil strife, leave terrible wounds. It is the duty of humanity to heal them. It was therefore soon conceived as neither wise nor patriotic to speak of all the causes of strife and the terrible results to which national differences in the United States had led. And so, first of all, we minimized the slavery controversy, which convulsed the nation from the Missouri Compromise down to the Civil War. On top of that, we passed by Reconstruction with a phase of regret or disgust. Further solidifying the sharp analysis of Du Bois on the creation and power of nation-creating myths, Cedric Robinson in Black Marxism, The Making of the Black Radical Tradition, argues that when examined properly, it can be understood that the formation of nation-states and the political reigns precipitate the development of founding myths, such as myths of origin. Citing Du Bois, Robinson writes that the bourgeoisie use of the print and press and their appeals to and the seduction of the classes they intend to dominate facilitated the fabrication of these national myths. These myths' sole purpose was to be recognized in the official instruments of class hegemony, national creeds, social ideologies, philosophical tenets, constitutions, etc. They function to legitimate the social orders that they create. As they begin to inform the social consciousness of everyone forced and freely a part of the social order, these myths were substituted for history. They provide the appearance of being a historical narrative when in fact they are actually nothing more than class-serving rationales for exploitation. The formation of the American state is no different. In fact, when properly contextualized, the American Constitution, the Declaration of Independence, the considerations in the Federalist Papers were all expressions of the interest and creed of the American bourgeoisie. Today, Dr. Greg Carr explores this period called Reconstruction. Dr. Carr is an associate professor of Africana Studies and chair of the Department of Afro-American Studies at Howard University and is on the faculty at the Howard School of Law. He holds a PhD in African American Studies from Temple University and a JD from the Ohio State University College of Law. Dr. Carr was the School District of Philadelphia's first resident scholar on race and culture. Dr. Carr led a team of academics and educators in the design of the curriculum framework for Philadelphia's mandatory high school African American history course. He is co-founder of the Philadelphia Freedom Schools Movement, a community-based academic initiative that has involved over 1,300 elementary, high school, and college students. Dr. Carr has presented his curriculum work for the Board of Public Education in Salvador, Bahia, and has lectured across the United States as well as the world. His publications have appeared in the African American Studies Reader, Socialism and Democracy, publications of the Modern Language Association of America, the Urban League's 2012 State of Black America, and Malcolm X, a Historical Reader, to name a few. Our show is produced today in solidarity with the Native, Indigenous, African, and Afro-descendant communities at Standing Rock, Venezuela, the Avalon Village in Detroit, Brazil, Colombia, Kenya, Corporation Jackson in Jackson, Mississippi, Palestine, South Africa, and Ghana, and other places who are fighting for the protection of our land for the benefit of all people. Enjoy the program.
So I feel like I'm okay with that. I was 2 years old in Alabama. My mother was born on a pallet on a floor in Russell County, Alabama. And her father was a farmer, just like a lot of folks, right? And he snuck me in the back room one day, and he used to drink coffee out of an iron cup with an iron saucer. And before they knew it, he had poured some of this black coffee with sugar onto the iron saucer. And I was back there, and he said, "Do what I do." And I was like, and he was like, "Hayes, where you got that boy? I'll leave that boy alone." So I blame my addiction on my grandfather. There are a few nobler, more noble things to do than share that moment with the elder. So anyway, I'm saying, and I know some of y'all have been through Nashville when it was a lot less, I want to say progressive, but I don't know what Nashville hot chicken is. That's another thing. If y'all eat Nashville hot chicken, that ain't what we was eating. But you've been through Nashville when it was a lot different than it is now. And so, are you good? Okay, I saw you pointing, man. You know, it's teacher's eyes. Anybody move untowardly? What? No. All right, so, but if you're going down I-65 south, like heading south, like going to Birmingham, you pass by on your left side a big monument surrounded by Confederate flags. Anybody know the monument I'm talking about? It's a monument to the founder of the Ku Klux Klan, 1866, Pulaski, Tennessee. And I know some of y'all know that name. Yes. He's also the guy that Middle Tennessee State University, which was created in Murfreesboro in part because they didn't want white kids to go to school with black kids, and they didn't want to integrate Tennessee State University, so they created this MTSU in Murfreesboro. He's the guy that their former mascot was named for, the Blue Raiders, because he was also a Confederate soldier, commander, Nathaniel Bedford Forrest. There's a monument to Nathaniel Bedford Forrest as we sit here right now, right in the Nashville, not even outside Nashville city limits, going right, you get right on the highway downtown Nashville, maybe a 20-minute walk, but 5 minutes by car from where I grew up, surrounded by the battle flag with Nathaniel Bedford Forrest, but it's on private land. We'll tie this together, the reconstruction, in a second. And the Nashville City Council voted to appropriate funds to create hedges to go up in front of it, but there's a battle about that because the guy set it up, since it's on his land. You know, there are a few of those things between here and, well, not a few, what am I saying, a few. Private property, and that's there right now. So it just made me think about it. But anyway, coming here, I got my assignment from General Minkart, and so, which is always a pleasure to get an assignment from you. And from those folks, as classroom teachers believe, we believe in the classroom. That's what we do. And so it's an honor to be here and in this space. When I got the assignment, I was like, I am not a to-the-bone expert in Reconstruction. Now, how many folks were in this room were at the 20th anniversary for the celebration of the Civil War Museum and our dear friend and y'all's colleague and comrade, Frank Smith, last month? Yes, so you remember. So David Blight was there, right? And I got a chance to speak to him. His book on Frederick Douglass is coming out. He's done a lot of work on this question of not only the period of Civil War and Reconstruction, but how do we, I don't want to say we, because ain't no we, how does America, there are many we's, how does America think about this? You probably maybe read his book, Race and Reunion. I said, well, David Blight could be here. Frank Smith could be here. A few people in this room could be sitting here. My approach to Reconstruction is very specific. One of them is the legal approach, which is why I'd be just glad, Dr. Jenkins, if you don't feel like working tonight, you can sit there and talk from there, but you could also give him get his talk about the legal structure and the legal premises of Reconstruction. Because, you know, Tim Jenkins, in addition to being Howard student body president, one of the members of SNCC, you know, also a lawyer and president of UDC. So he knows how to walk through this a lot better. And, of course, we know University of District Columbia was 1857, is it? In the decade just before the beginning of Reconstruction. So DC has a very important role in this. So, I mean, he could do that. So, I teach it at Howard Law because I think it is the most important moment in American legal history. It's not a negligible moment. And, we'll talk more about that in a second. And the other reason is, and the other thing is, I've already said it. You know, you get bombastic with language. This is the most important. This is the most important. I don't like really do that. But it's very difficult having been raised in the American South, having learned nothing, because I think we learned it the same way. In the South, we didn't learn anything. But when you learn a little bit about Reconstruction, it's the War of Northern Aggression. It's still the war between the states. I remember the first time I went to Mother Emanuel, where Alphonso Pinckney and them got killed by Dylan Roth and them. Meaning all the demons in his head, not the white supremacists who cheered him on. And I'm sure probably still trying to figure out a way to get his sentence commuted. Never trust anybody down 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. But I remember the first time I went to Mother Emanuel Baptist Church, and AME rather, I'm sorry, y'all AME, AME Church, and went around, you know, looking around in Charleston. This is Denmark Vesey's church. Man, Morris Brown was down here, who's buried in Philly because they banned free Negroes from South Carolina. You couldn't even come back, you know? And so, but I remember, and the plaques in that city still call it the war between the states. So, I mean, Reconstruction still seen in many ways as an intrusion, as an imposition on the South. It's the foundation for the notion of states' rights and leave us alone, except if we have the power, the tension between the federal government and states. So the reason that I hesitated, but will go on and say what is often in my mind at those moments, is that it's hard to put one moment ahead of another. But in some ways, and that's probably the way to qualify it, Reconstruction is the most important period in American history. So for it not only not to be taught, but when it is taught, to be glossed with one narrative is fine with me, because I have no investment in the United States as an experiment. So if you want to teach it that way, fine. But what you're going to realize is that you won't have a country soon. Because the lessons of Reconstruction are really, hey, Judy, send somebody else come and teach this class. The lessons of Reconstruction are really the lessons of what is the possibility of America, in a sentence, to me. And how you teach Reconstruction, how we study and learn Reconstruction, really is opening up the playbook to whether there's a possibility for a continuing American state. And if so, how would you do it? Because as Jesse Jackson used to say, you know, and I'm sure he wasn't the only one to say it, but it's like, you know, deal us in or cut it out. That's really almost, you can kind of summarize Reconstruction in that, and deal us in or cut us out. And when you deal us in, you get public education. When you deal us in, you get this notion of enforcement of rights. But when you cut us out, you get the type of white supremacy that can't be sustained. And it's going to collapse. So let me do this very quickly. As I said, we're gonna have a conversation. So let me do this. I'll tell y'all one more story, and then I think I'm gonna ask some questions and we'll get talking and we can just add the dates. We can go through it. I mean, Reconstruction, very simple. 1865 to 1877 is typically what they would have in the book. If they have anything, that's usually federal Reconstruction. We can talk about what those dates mean and walk through it year by year, and that will be, you know, sufficient. But I think it will emerge as we have this conversation. But I'll tell you this one story. Back in 2010, the New York Historical Society had a exhibition on revolutions. I don't remember that, Judy. Oh my goodness. So I went up there to see it. And they had a copy of the Haitian Constitution, the one that was drafted by the Haitians, you know, and then Tucson gets sold out and Dessalines comes in. You know, shout out to Brooklyn now. They got a street name for Dessalines, even though city council, there was some controversy about that. But they write this thing. So everybody in Haiti is like politically black. Blackness becomes like a legal kind of name. Forget the phenotype. We're going to make everybody equal. But to make everybody equal, we're not going to trend to the whiteness. We're going to use black as the normative assumption. But if you don't want to be black, you can leave. But if you're going to stay here, you're going to be black. This whole notion of it. So they had the Haitian Constitution. And they had the 13th Amendment, the one that Lincoln saw and put his name on. This is the preliminary draft amendment before he gets killed down the street in April, right, 65. And, you know, Lincoln, through his tortured nights of the soul, you know, do we free these Negroes and send them to Nicaragua or Haiti somewhere? Can't send them to Haiti. She come back over here with guns. But what do we do? You know, he'd already battled back and forth with Frederick Douglass and then Martin Delaney. It's like, I don't want nothing except give me the guns and I'll go get the dudes, which is why he might have got the commission as the first commissioned major in the United States military, a thing that Douglass kind of bristled at, because Douglass, you should have given it to me. But I think in Lincoln's mind, maybe, or at least to read the scholarship on it, maybe in Lincoln's mind, Martin Delaney doesn't care about me, you, or anybody else. He's trying to get black people free, and I need to win this war. So, I mean, Lincoln is, you know, he's going through his permutations, and he's on his way to his Gethsemane, and then I guess his Calvary. You know, I gave a talk at the National Archive one time called Abraham Lincoln, American Jesus. Because it's like, no, really, because if George Washington the father, clearly Abraham Lincoln is the Jesus, he's the son, which might make Martin Luther King the Holy Ghost. But America needs its civic religion. And Abraham Lincoln is the above reproach, elevated, sacrificial lamb that cements the whole proposition. Forget Reconstruction and Grant. And James Garfield, who had he lived, might have been more interesting than Lincoln. You know, this abolitionist, anti-slavery congressman from Ohio who gets a little bit, you know, kind of lukewarm a little bit later. Then he runs for president, wins the presidency, and then gets killed, right? But Lincoln signed this piece of paper they had at New York Historical Society. Said, I want to go up here and see this. Because when you get a chance to see something, you don't get a chance to see much. Go see it, right? So I'm going through the Revolutions exhibit, and then downstairs, they have the 13th Amendment. Except, you don't know in the exhibit upstairs on Revolutions that the 13th Amendment is down there. It just so happened they were on display at the same time. So I'm looking at this, and I'm thinking, this is a piece of paper, here's a case, and here I am looking at it. I'm looking at a piece of paper that was arguing over whether I was a human being or not. And I was upstairs with a constitution that assumed my humanity in a country that was much more advanced than the one I'm in, one that Lincoln didn't recognize till 1863, Haiti. It was much better advanced on race than this. And yet in the narrative, this is the thing I'm supposed to be happy about. And he didn't live to see it passed. The second part of the story, a year later, they had a Magna Carta at the J.P. Morgan Library in New York. So I got on the bus. Let me go over and see Magna Carta. I hadn't seen one till then. And I think that's before Rubenstein bought two or three and left one down here in the National Archive. You know, you got money like that. But you know, I fixed the Washington Monument. I don't want my name on it, except somewhere discreetly. So everybody, anyway. But so I hadn't seen the Rubenstein when it's down there. So I'm gonna go see Magna Carta, because as a legal student, I won't say scholar, real suspicious. People call themselves scholars. I'm like, oh, yes, you know, it's like on a basketball court. You know, I'm the woman, I'm the man. No, you need to come out here and play. So anybody announce they're a scholar, I'm like, okay, all right. I mean, I'm not saying they're not. I'm just saying I won't be the one to say that. Y'all say, and you say about me, I'm probably going to cringe. So I'm saying, but as a student, I'm saying, I want to see this Magna Carta. So I went up there. I went to J.P. Morgan Library. I'm looking at the Magna Carta. I'm like, wow. This is the Magna Carta. And the only reason it was there, because remember, I was thinking it was 2011. They had that volcano erupted in Europe, and it messed up all the flights, because they were supposed to send it back, but they had an extended stay because they couldn't guarantee whatever the flights. Okay, so I'm looking at it. And then I toured. Who has been to the J.P. Morgan Library and Museum? You have. Yeah, of course you have. Did you take the guided tour, or did you? The guided tour. Not the self-guided with the earphones. They tell you about Bell DaCosta Green? Okay, that's good. I'm glad I had a guided tour, because I'd have messed it up. I kept asking questions. I had the earphones, because you don't really like people. I don't like no shade to any. I know there's a lot of docents in here. I'm not a docent person, because while any docent is talking, I'm thinking in my mind, how are you narrating this? Who trained you to narrate it? At what point are you arguing with the narrative you were trained with, or how point did you buy? So I mean, I don't need a human being, because my tendency with human beings is to talk to them. So I got the earphones, man, because I got to listen to this. Well, I got to go slow. I want to think about this. So here's J.P. Morgan. Here's his study where they had the financial crisis in the 1870s. He basically wrote the check with his friends, mailing them guys, and they bailed out America. That plays in Reconstruction, too, because there was an economic collapse in the 1870s, right? And arguably, that exacerbated the tensions in America to hurry up and get this Negro Reconstruction stuff behind us, because we are about to go broke. So you go into a place where Morgan had, you know, he's with his buddies. They pull the money together, and basically create a situation that we still have, which is what? The government now is owned or owed by these private bankers, right? So I'm standing in the study like, damn, this is where it went down. This is where they wrote the check. Wow. So I go in the other room. Let me hurry this up. So there's a big office in one of the corridors. And in the earphones it says, this is the office of J.P. Morgan's book buyer and the woman who was the librarian for the J.P. Morgan collection, one of the finest collect. He got Gutenberg's. He's got all these. And she went all over the world collecting books for Morgan. He gave her a blank checkbook, and she went and bought stuff. You got to go if you ever go to the J.P. Morgan. You got to go and see. This is an incredible library. Several Gutenberg's, in fact. So, if you're into that kind of thing. So, it says, but all the time she was traveling through Europe, and all the time the people were in wonder of her acquisition skills and her knowledge of books and bibliography, she had a secret that even Morgan didn't know. For the secret, press the button. Boop. Like. Now, I'm standing there by myself, because other people touring, stop, keep going, stop, keep going. But I'm on the phone, so I'm going slow. And I'm, boop. She was black. This is the thing. I'm like, yo, how did everybody, y'all walk right by the... Belle DaCosta Green, after her mother left her father and changed their name from Greener. Some of y'all know I'm going with this. Might know a famous Greener here in D.C.? Graduate of Harvard Law School. One time dean of the Howard University School of Law. Richard T. Greener. Argued at the end of Reconstruction with Frederick Douglass over whether black people should stay here or leave. Belle DaCosta Green, part of the acrimony between she and her father's, you know, her father, the family, changed her name and passed for white for the rest of her life. And then she said, I'm Brazilian, DaCosta, that's where they come from, right? And so she's going all over the world. And I don't think, they don't even think Morgan knew she was black. Now, what does that have to do with Reconstruction? Richard T. Greener, who was arguing with Douglas after Reconstruction is over, is whether we should even continue this proposition. In fact, he tore Douglas up so bad in one debate that they were supposed to do another debate, and Douglas wrote and said, I'm predisposed, I can't really come. Because Greener had outlined his, why are you arguing immigration with an E? Let's just leave. You saw what they did. You argued with these people from before the Civil War all the way through the Reconstruction, and they turned their backs. Now, Greener by then is living in New York, which is why Belle DaCosta ends up there. He is the one who spearheads the committee, and I learned this after Gil Scott Heron's funeral. I didn't know this when I was listening to this. I went across the street waiting for the funeral to start because I was there so early because I figured ain't nobody going to be able to get in, so let me get here real early. I went across the street to Grant's tomb. Richard Greener was the head of the committee that raised the money for Grant's tomb because black Americans understood the role that Ulysses S. Grant played in Reconstruction. He may have been the only guy in the government who could have done what he did, even though he didn't go all the way. As an ex-general who Andrew Johnson tried to replace Stanton in the war cabinet with Greener, who then comes back and runs for president, who then puts the heavy hand down on the South and gets us closer to what is probably the heart of Reconstruction from 1865 to 1877. And they have a lesson. Y'all got a lesson for that on the website, that 1868 year. 1868, I think, who was the guy that wrote that lesson? You remember that? I don't remember his name. Sanchez, yes. Adam Sanchez wrote the lesson, but he's quoting Lerone Bennett. 1868. And of course, you know, people say, oh, we don't have historians who are writing about Reconstruction. No, what you have in 2018 is people who are going to make a cottage industry and making a name for themselves. And the first thing you do in academia to make a name for yourself is say nobody did it. Ah, yes, there it is right there. Oh, thank you. Of course. Look, see, this is what, look, everything is not on the internet. In fact, most of it's not on the internet. If this is digitized, it don't matter. This book right here, yes, Black Power USA by the recent ancestor, Lerone Bennett Jr., going back to Reconstruction, 1868, not 1968, which is extremely important, but 1868. That's when the government is riding high enough. Johnson's back has been broken. He's out. Grant's in office, and they put that military government down with those five divisions on the South, and they say, y'all not gonna do this. They pass the Civil Rights Act of 1866, which gives positive rights. It's one thing to have an amendment that says you won't discriminate. But in the Civil Rights Act of 1866, what the federal government through Congress says is, no, you have the right to make and enforce contracts. You have the right to do what white people have the right to do. That is the most powerful to this day. The Civil War amendments are great, but what does it do? It bonds citizenship to the one thing in this country that's more powerful than anything else, whiteness. So you can't be colorblind if you put white in it. The minute you take white out, that's when John Roberts can do all this legal sophistry. And Kavanaugh, whose confirmation hearings are going to start Tuesday. We'll talk about that. Pause. That was the story. Now, we continue like we were doing before. All right, so. Somebody who knows something about, what's up, hottie? I don't know you, man. Your mom says, okay, for me to talk to you. You got to clear with your mama. I was clearing stuff with my mama yesterday from 80-year-olds. And I know your mama said, but anyway. And how do black women keep secrets? That's a whole nother thing. I learned stuff yesterday. I'm like, I'm a 53-year-old man. How did y'all keep this secret from me? I'm old enough to get it. Not quite. There are some others. Maybe. Anyway. What do we know about Reconstruction? All right. When you think of Reconstruction, what's the first thing come to mind? We don't need the microphone necessarily for that necessarily, but what's the first thing comes to mind? Black rights, slavery,
lynching.
Who?
Voting,
yes.
Birth of a nation,
yes. The engine, right? You love the book, you love the movie, right? Birth of a Nation and Gone with the Wind. Those two books turn into movies. Margaret Mitchell has a bloodline link to Civil War and Reconstruction, but the people who read her book and then watch that movie don't. So in many ways, Reconstruction narrative is based on this myth-making of Hollywood and, of course, Birth of a Nation. But of course, when Birth of a Nation comes out in 1915, there's still a lot of people who fought in that war, who lived through Reconstruction, who are still around. By 1939, it's a little bit different. And then, of course, we keep remaking the same movie over and over again. So yes, all those terms, all right? Why was Reconstruction necessary? AJ. See, I can get Barry them up here.
Because you had to do something to 3 million people who were formerly slaves.
What about the people who weren't?
And you had to deal with the freemen also.
Yes. So you got all them, I'll call them what Callie House. Anybody know who Callie House is? Callie House was a woman. Yeah, of course. Tell everybody who Callie House is. Hey, she right here. Yes.
Callie House was one of the two founders of the reparations movement.
That's right. That was Isaiah Dickerson, I think, was it? Yes. My homies, they were in Nashville. So when you said slave, I was starting to say slave, but we can say what Callie House and Isaiah Dickerson would call them, because they had an organization called the Ex-Slave Mutual Relief and Pension Fund. You know, question. The ex-slave, you're like, I'm an ex-slave. Okay, we got the pension for you, and they end up, federal government ended up putting her in jail. So when Marcus Garvey was the first one to go to jail after being trailed by the feds, it was Callie House. In fact, Mary Frances Berry wrote a very important biography of hers called My Face is Black is True. Yes, so Callie House, so I could say ex-slave. Yes, they were ex-slaves, right? But what about the poor whites? Question, how many people think that who do you think had more deserters, the Confederate Army or the Union Army? Why the Confederate? I ain't own no slaves. I mean, I hear Dixie, and I know y'all want us to have this Southern pride, but man, the biggest gap I have is between the owners and me. In fact, all the literature of black folk culture and black songs, Lord, this child is here. I'm going to say it right quick. He don't hear. Well, I won't say it. You can use your context clues. There was a song that some of the, in fact, one of the phrases, you probably heard the phrase, poor white trash. That's not a phrase black people created, but they used it liberally during enslavement to say, yeah, he owned the plantation, but you don't. And there was a song, I forget where I read this. This may have been William Lehman's book or some of the books that collect these songs. My name is Dan. I work in the sand. I'd rather be a poor white man. So the poor whites who get conscripted into this army of the Confederacy, they're deserting, many of them. Now, the people who write the history of Civil War and Reconstruction try to make the argument that perhaps that was more impactful than any single event in the Confederacy losing the war. But we know why the Confederacy lost the war. Du Bois writes about it in Black Reconstruction in America, which is still the book to start with, right? Black people stopped working in the fields. Then started running all kinds, then they had the Contraband Act and stuff, and then started running off to the Union lines, and then came back with guns. Lincoln ain't free nobody. The American Negro freed himself. Amen. They wouldn't give Harriet Tubman, and I love that shirt. They wouldn't give Araminta, they wouldn't give Harriet Tubman a military commission, but that didn't stop her from showing the Union troops what to burn on the Eastern Shore of Maryland, making her probably the first woman to direct troops in battle in this country. So anybody freed? No, we freed ourselves, right? And then.
We are currently listening to Dr. Greg Carr contextualize and critically engage this period of U.S. history called Reconstruction. Another important lasting implication of the settler colonial Reconstruction period deals directly with the question and future of labor. A point that must be a platform upon which we begin to seriously critique the purpose and trajectory of labor, labor unions, and other labor-related organizations. Writing in Marxism and the Negro Problem, Du Bois argues that the black proletariat is not a part of the white proletariat. While Negro labor in America suffers because of the fundamental inequities of the whole capitalist system, the lowest and most fatal degree of its suffering comes not from the capitalists, but from fellow white laborers. It is this white labor that deprives the Negro of his right to vote, denies him education, denies him affiliation with trade unions, expels him from decent housing and neighborhoods, and heaps upon him the public insults of open color discrimination. We are currently listening to Dr. Greg Carr, who is an associate professor of Africana Studies and the chair of the Department of Afro-American Studies at Howard University and on faculty at the Howard School of Law. He holds a PhD in African-American Studies from Temple University and a JD from the Ohio State University College of Law. Dr. Carr was the School District of Philadelphia's first resident scholar on race and culture, in which he led a team of academics and educators at the design of the curriculum framework for Philadelphia's mandatory high school African-American history course. He is a co-founder of the Philadelphia Freedom Schools Movement, a community-based academic initiative that has involved over 1,300 elementary, high school, and college students. Dr. Carr has presented his curriculum work for the Board of Public Education in Salvador Bahia and has lectured across the United States as well as the world. His publications have appeared in, among other places, the African American Studies Reader, Socialism and Democracy, publications of the Modern Language Association of America, the National Urban League's 2012 State of Black America, and Malcolm X, a historical reader, to name a few. Please continue to enjoy the program.
So anybody freed? No, we freed ourselves, right? And then they created the Freedmen's Bureau. Who is they? Lincoln is dead, right? April 1865, Lincoln is dead. Who's the president after that? Andrew Johnson. What does anybody know about my homie, Andrew Johnson? I went to pay my respects when I went home in May. I drove out to his gravesite to pay my respects. I'll leave it up to your imagination what that looked like. So, yeah, Raleigh, North Carolina is where he born, but he buried in East Tennessee, along with a little bit of me. So what do we know about Andrew Johnson? This is being recorded. But that's all right, y'all. Ain't none of us free, but we're going to be free today. He was a pure bum by even white standards. Why did he get killed the night Lincoln got? They sent somebody to off him, right? Anybody know why Johnson didn't get killed or why he elevated his likelihood that he wouldn't get assassinated at night? But they cut Seward cheek and they tried to say, why didn't Johnson get got? Johnson had a taste for alcohol too. Most people, if you learn anything in history about Andrew Johnson, it was that he liked alcohol a lot and he indulged to excess. So whether he was not where he was supposed to be because he was at the bar or whatever. But what else do we know about Andrew Johnson? Anybody? He was a bum, but why is he a bum? That's a visceral. You say a bum. That's how I felt about him, too. I ain't call him a bum. My word was a little bit longer when I saw him. You could put a hyphenated sometime, too. But anybody? Johnson is in some ways like, I don't know, LBJ. I hate to make that comparison. His elevation to the national ticket is as much about they need those votes. But Andrew Johnson was an unreconstructed Southerner who stayed with the Union. He's born in North Carolina, but he lived in Tennessee. In fact, he came back to Congress after they impeached him and failed by one vote of putting him out. He came back to this set town as a senator and served in the United States Senate after he was the president, right? There have been a few people who do that, just love being in D.C. and getting the public dole. But Johnson, from Tennessee by that time, is still in the Union. And he's the vice president to Lincoln, which means even, you know, most vice presidents, unlike Dick Cheney, and God forbid, I hate to say, I mean, if Trump gets out, y'all find out what it is. You're going to find out what it is with that dude, Smiling Mike Pence. He would fit well during Reconstruction. In fact, his Klan rhetoric is almost perfectly aligned with the Ku Klux Klan. Because, you know, the Ku Klux Klan is a Christian organization. Yeah, so Smiling Mike Pence would fit in right fine with that intolerance and everything. You know, you could go back to the Reconstruction era. You'll be fine in one of them Southern governments threatening violence. But we'll get to that. So, yeah, Johnson was not supposed to be president. Lincoln gets killed, Johnson's in, and so the hope is, well, maybe because he was with us and he has disdain for the planter class, because he was kind of poor while he was a tailor, right? He might be tough on the South. No such luck. 1865 and 1866, Johnson is in the paint rejecting every volley from the Congress. Get that wheat out of here. There will be no legislation that's going to overly impose these undue burdens on the South. I'm going to let them back in, if I can, with very little conditions, very few conditions. What happens if you let the Southern states back in with very few conditions during Reconstruction, during the early days of Reconstruction? They're allowed back in. What would happen? Same thing, and that's what they started doing. They say, okay, so we can come back in. Y'all got this 13th Amendment that you passed. Should we even honor that? They're having the debates now. If you read, discuss. In fact, this is what I want to do before going any further, and we'll keep this going. There's a lot of good scholarship, but this book right here, y'all know the series, what they call it, of America, Library of America? Yes. This is the one edited by Brooks Simpson. Reconstruction, Voices from America's First Great Struggle for Racial Equality. This one just came out, I want to say 2018, yeah, came out this year. It's a nice one volume. There are a lot of documents out there, a lot of stuff. And again, when you're reading through the ZenEd documents, this is a nice supplement to have because it's all primary documents. I'm going to read for a couple in a minute as we keep going. But what you see is, you see Johnson justifying why he will not support these laws that are being passed. And while he's doing that, the Southern states start passing laws restricting the rights of black people. Anybody know the names of those laws, what they were known as? Exactly. See, that's what I'm saying. I ain't got to do all this. The black codes. So a lot of times in school, young people will get black codes if they hear about it at all. Confused with Jim Crow. Neither of those really has much to do with Reconstruction because the Congress will come in after Johnson has really showed out and push him aside. In fact, and Jim Crow comes after Reconstruction as a direct consequence of the failure of Reconstruction. Get my glasses. because I'm already more animated than I thought I would be, because I'm dog tired. I came here straight from the airport, and I was going to be all scholarly and quiet voiced. That's a fantasy I have every once in a while. I'm going to do it. I'm going to do it one day. I don't recognize that Negro. It's very quiet. So I had to look and make sure, because I was writing from memory, so I wanted to put my stuff down. So they override Johnson's vetoes in 1866. But while they're overriding his vetoes, two things. Number one, Johnson is getting more and more loose with his talk. He does a national tour for the midterm elections where he tries to go out and recruit people to his way of thinking, and it ends up being more disastrous for him. Now, this is how politics works, right? We're talking about federal Reconstruction. Who does he have with him on the tour that he goes around the country trying to get whip up people for his position? Ulysses S. Grant. Why is Grant with Johnson? When we know Grant's politics are not Johnson's politics. Why do y'all think? He's the winning general. So he's following orders in part. It's also politics. See, it's crazy when you play with the lives of citizens because you have ambition. Why are you out there with Johnson? Johnson uses Grant, as I mentioned before, but now I can put it in context. He uses Grant because one of the laws they pass and then override his veto is a law that says you can't make cabinet appointments and then get rid of them without our consent, without Congress's consent. This is the beginning of what they're going to call radical Reconstruction. They can't trust Johnson. Now imagine that. You got a secretary in your cabinet you want to get rid of, and Congress passed a law over your veto that says you can't get rid of one once you've appointed them without our consent. Y'all think that's legal? How many people think it's legal? How many people think that that's unconstitutional? Separation of powers. You got Article 1, 2, and 3, right? Yes, of course, right? Therein lies the arbitrariness of law. I know y'all love the Constitution. What did Gil Scott Heron say? The Constitution. The Constitution. A noble piece of paper. Yeah. It's words. Can you enforce it? In fact, let me skip forward for 30 seconds before I go back. 1923, Giles versus Alabama. By then, Reconstruction is over. Oliver Wendell Holmes, whose father was in the Civil War, here go Oliver Wendell Holmes Jr. They love him. He's on the Supreme Court. Oliver Wendell Holmes says, in Alabama, you can't prevent these black men from voting. And yet, he says, in Giles versus Alabama, there's no need for us to go ahead and articulate that as a constitutional fact, because even if we articulate it, we don't have an army. And ultimately, the power of the law only extends as far as its enforceability. If you want to test that, all you got to do is go to the border today. Oh, no, not to the border. Go to New York or any of these other child abduction facilities. We broke the law, but yeah, but you ain't got no army. I got the army. So anyway, all right, back to the story. So Johnson is being checked by Congress, and they tell him he can't do it. So he tries to suspend his Secretary of War, Stanton, who was with Lincoln, because they don't trust him. Congress is like, nah. And who did he put in? Grant. Grant becomes Secretary of War for a minute. And then Congress tells Grant, dude, you're breaking the law. So Grant demurs. He says, okay, I'm going to pull back. Then Johnson fires the Secretary of War. And by then, he's done so many other things, which he's vetoed the Reconstruction Acts, which are held by the Supreme Court to be constitutional. In fact, one of the Reconstruction Acts that he overrides, that he vetoes, that they override, he vetoed that act on March the 2nd, 1867. Why is that date important? They know the chant, but they don't know the answer to that question. H-U. Let's do it again. H-U. Do you know? Then on March the 2nd, 1867, Andrew Johnson, perhaps drunk, signed the charter for Howard University because it was in a stack of papers. Maybe he didn't know what he was signing. And on that same day, he vetoed the Reconstruction Act, checking his power. To this day, nobody knows. I don't know. Dr. Jenkins, what do you think? Do you think he knew what he was signing when he signed Howard's charter? I trust you, Michael Winston, probably more than anybody on this. What do you think? Oh, you think he knew? Oh, now that's a book. Look. Dr. Chele gonna say something for him. What y'all think?
Betsy DeVos would have said he believed in school choice.
That's true. I choose this school for you niggas. That's right. That's true. But it wasn't a black school. Anyway, right. It wasn't a black school. Yes, we're gonna get that. Reconstruction. We're gonna come in a minute. Yes, please. Dr. Chele, yes.
Hi, Hickna. But wasn't he like
functionally illiterate for much of his adult life. His wife taught him how to read. You know, he came from that working class background.
See, we got this room. I'm glad we loosened it up. No, he wasn't even working class. This clay eater. Anyway, that's a real term of art from the 19th century. But yes. No, this dude, who knew he? Nah. But the thing about Howard was it wasn't a school for black people. Right. It was a school that did not discriminate by race. This is the spirit of Reconstruction. Now, as John Henry Clark, you say, in some stories, it ain't no good guy, because I ain't no General Howard fan, because after all, while he was being so magnanimous and creating a school, we gotta go to school, he's also chasing Chief Seattle to the Pacific Ocean. Y'all read his new book, Thunder in the Mountains. I mean, you know, he's a Christian general, but what does that mean to be Christian? You know, American Jesus Abraham Lincoln, you know, same day he signs the Emancipation Proclamation. I believe it's the same day. Y'all can check it. But I think that's when he signed the death warrant for Little Crow and them. Come on, Lauren Crest. Tell us about what we're about to say.
Well, I just know that he's signing the Emancipation Proclamation and sending troops to kill the Native Americans.
Exactly right. Go read the book, 38 Nooses. Ooh. The largest public execution in American history that day. Abraham Lincoln signed the death warrant. Now, he did. They say, well, he commuted a lot. Yeah, but he killed a lot more. Fort Snelling. Talk about American history. This thing is like a bizarre story. It's stranger than fiction. Fort Snelling, which I made them take me to when I went to Minneapolis. I said, I got to go to Fort Snelling. Why? Because this is where Little Crow and them were, and they killed all them Lakota. And this is also the place that Dred and Harriet Scott were with that dude who had them. In this fort in the upper Mississippi Valley, because you know, Minnesota is also the Mississippi. So yes, Lincoln, gone, Johnson signs the charter for Howard. Maybe he did know. That would be a heck of an article, Doc. Because that would be, well, they would use it to redeem Johnson. So maybe, no, don't write that article. One with Johnson redeemed. I'm coming to that in a minute. Narratives are very important, which is why we don't know this Reconstruction history. So Johnson then signs vetoes the Reconstruction Act. And when he he tries to fire Stanton and they override that, they say, you know what? That's it. This guy got to go. That's when they impeached him. And by one vote, Senate, he survives. But by then, he's so weak, he's out giving talks. He's like, this guy has lost his mind. I mean, you know, it kind of looked like the guy who's down there now. You see him going out giving talks, and fewer people is like, is he all right? I mean, is he well? The guy's clearly not. Grant wins the election, and Grant comes into office. That's 1868, right? I can't see, so let me look. I put my little notes down because this is all stuff I know by heart, but you want to make sure it's right when you get a command to come in here with y'all, because I know how y'all are. And I'm grateful for it. Believe me. Oh, yes, I forgot that. I need to write that down. While they're getting their feet up under them fighting Johnson in 1867, they also passed a law declaring that black men can vote in the District of Columbia. So they extend suffrage, right? Because remember, Lincoln is toying with the idea of emancipation, but is it going to be partial, is it going to be total, or is it going to be compensated? So you remember what he did in 1863, right? That's why we have Emancipation Day in this city. But it's compensated emancipation. I'm going to free you, but I'm going to pay the people. So while Johnson is in, the South is kind of like, well, you know, this is what the plantocracy is saying. Maybe we could get paid compensation for these Africans. Meanwhile, Rufus Sexton and them during the war is like, no, we're going to divide this property up and give it to these Africans. And we got some old army mules and stuff, which is why the one thing out of Reconstruction that we all probably heard of was at least the phrase what? Exactly. So some got through that. That's right, Lerone. That's right. But no, really, that becomes probably the single element of Reconstruction that resonated. And that was not an urban legend. But it was Lincoln in the paint that time who said, nah, get that out of here, Rufus. We can't give them that because some of the Republicans in Congress decide, they said, no, impose our will on the South. They lost the war. They left the federal polity. Divide the land up and give it to the people. That was the lost promise. Now, we're going to do that now? What's the young sister, Borica, out of New York? Ocasio? You're a socialist. Oh, you think she's a socialist? Go back to 1863, and this is the military. This is the military in South Carolina. And guess what? When they decided they weren't going to do that and they rescinded their order, who did they send to talk to them? Anybody read? Vincent Harding, another ancestor, colleague of Lerone Bennett, read his book, There Is a River. Oh, he writes about this beautifully. they sent General Howard. And they said, General Howard's in there telling them y'all ain't gonna get this land. And he said, and Vincent Harding writes that you hear this song start coming up out of the assembly group. Nobody knows. And it's getting louder and that Howard trying, well, it's gonna be all right. No, the trouble. Y'all gotta read Vincent Harding. Now remind you now, people say, well, this is not history that's been told. No, it's been told. And one of the blessings of Teaching for Change and Zen Education is they're going to link you to those texts that have been here, some of them 40, 50 years, or in Du Bois's case, since 1935. So don't go from what people tell you. I've written a path-breaking book. I don't know. It might be path-breaking. But did you read those other five? This work has been going. In fact, we'll talk about that in a second. The contemporaries during Reconstruction also wrote. That's why this. I love this book, because all that stuff is by people who were there. And it isn't all men. You gotta read what Frances Ellen Watkins Harper is writing. You know, out of Baltimore, lived in Philly, school teacher. She's laying it down. And then when she writes that poem, Bury Me in a Free Land, come on. This is Reconstruction. I'm all for intersectionality. And I remember when Kim Crenshaw wrote that article, I was in law school. This is powerful. But unfortunately, I had also read a lot of other stuff by then, so I realized it wasn't a new discussion. And with Sojourner Truth, and Ain't I a Woman? Why? Because Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Susan B. Anthony, oh, you gonna get a devote to Sambo before you give it to your wives and daughters? Sojourner said, oh, I'm a woman, right? Damn, you just jumped over the black woman. Fred, I understand you want everybody had a vote, bro. But let's be clear, the battle over the 15th Amendment, that Reconstruction argument, is gender shot all through there. But that's as intersectional as it's ever been in American history. And that's what people who felt the whip. So this is not a bunch of us who ain't felt the whip. I know we've suffered. But compared to that, they were right at the heat. Imagine what those debates look like. Imagine Sojourner Truth in that room with nobody else but her. And she's like, nah, this train got to slow. But if you read the history, when it's divided out by race, class, and gender, and then put back together as if anybody lives those things separately, it looks like you can do an analysis of something that you can't do in real life. So rewind this, and then to a conclusion. I'm looking at 6 o'clock, so we a little bit after six, we can go. 1868, the Republicans have won. They got Johnson on his heels. Grant is in, and the new constitutions are rewritten. The new constitutions are written in the South. They got these Southern states that have rewritten their constitutions. I had to write them all down so I wouldn't leave anybody. Alabama, Arkansas, Louisiana, South Carolina, Georgia, North Carolina, and Florida. Oh my God, it's the SEC. Yeah. I'm sorry. I'm going to save that for the contemporary implications of Reconstruction. Because you know that's what integration means in higher ed, right? We want the 4.4, you with the 4.0, and the rest of y'all go to hell. So last night when Nick Saban dropped 50 on Louisville for University of Alabama, and my cousins from Alabama are watching the game, it reminded me of the lost promise of Reconstruction. They're going to cheer for Alabama. Are y'all going to cheer for Alabama when people in this room put their bodies on the line to make Section 2 of the 14th Amendment stand up? And after that, they said, okay, integration is good. We're going to make all the money. I just want those 50 niggas on teams. Now, the rest of y'all go, we're integrated now, but these are all black schools. Now, go look at Section Title 6 of the Civil Rights Act of 1964 that they put their bodies on the line to get passed. And you look at the Title 6, now Title, they tried to use Title 6 to say the HBCUs can no longer exist because you can't have racially identifiable schools. But the reason they can call them racially identifiable is because they're not going by the Civil Rights Act of 1866, where they say you have the right to be treated like a white man. They're going by this notion of colorblindness that they read into the documents over the arc of the last 50 years. So let me get back to where I was talking. So these new constitutions are written, these state constitutions. Do you think they were good or bad as a whole? Better or worse, rather? Not yet. That comes Jim Crow. They're better because who's in control? The Republicans, right? They've broken Andrew Johnson's back. They got the general in as the president. They got the South under military divisions. And you can't come back into the Union until not only you got to swear loyalty, you got to let these people vote, right? This is before the 15th Amendment. But they put laws in place to protect these black people. And the constitutions that are being written, if you go look at the Constitution of Mississippi from 1868 and look at the Constitution of Mississippi now, that's an exercise that'll make y'all laugh and weep open tears at the same time. How is the Constitution of 1868 more progressive? Because that was a foreign country in the mind of some of those congressmen and senators. Johnson, you was going to let them back in, and you going to let them keep their land? You gave them their land? Oh, you know what? Well, okay, fine. We got to put some rules in place. Oh, you going to veto it? Oh, okay. Oh, you going to fire the guy anyway? Impeach this guy. Oh, you know what? Leave him alone. Why? Because he done going around the country talking crazy. He going to lose the next election. Who we run? Grant. Grant will win. Grant swept the place. And when he was reelected, guess who put him in? The votes of black men around the country. That was his margin of victory. And that's not anything I would touch, because at the 20th anniversary of the Civil War Museum, we had the best exposition of that. Somebody went down through the districts, went through the regions, said this is how black people put Grant in. Black people, we talk now and say your vote matters. People say my vote doesn't matter. Go back and read Reconstruction. So anyway, those were written, and that's 1868. 1869, of course, the 15th Amendment is passed. Oh, I'm sorry. 1869, the 15th Amendment. We can talk about the battle for the 15th Amendment a little bit later if people want to continue talking about it. But there are two major parties in the United States at this time. This is after the Whigs and Democratic Republicans have gone through the collapse of, you know, that before, and then the Know Nothing Party comes and goes. Lincoln and them putting together this GOP, it comes in. Party of business, but, you know, slavery's bad for business. So you can have the radical people in there as well. But now by 1869, we're past the major year. Probably, has anybody heard the phrase radical reconstruction? Okay, there's no such thing. There's congressional reconstruction. There's military reconstruction, but the most radical people in the Congress couldn't get what they wanted, then as now. They wanted to divide the land up and give it to the Africans. They wanted to give it to the, that didn't get passed. So people say radical reconstruction, it's radical compared to what? I didn't see, did anybody watch the John McCain funeral? Anybody watch the Aretha Franklin funeral? Exactly, I did the same thing. So. Listen, and that's no shade on John McCain. He is a person who was tortured for his country. I can't say war hero because I'm not sure that that was a war. But he, I don't know. I'm just saying. But I'm saying this. I mean, I know Bill Clinton was at both, so I'm saying they don't make planes that Obama can ride on. But anyway, I mean, you didn't send your mama, somebody, mother-in-law, the kids, somebody to Aretha Franklin's funeral, since we did what for you, what black people did for Grant back there in Reconstruction. But at any rate, and unlike Grant, you didn't do nothing for us, right? So, but anyway, I know some of y'all love Obama, so I'm gonna come back to the point. But my point is that when you're looking at people praise John McCain like that, compared to what? So when you say radical reconstruction, yeah, it was radical compared to the alternative, but it wasn't radical the way it could have been. Because in 1868, when they rewrite those constitutions, that's when Hiram Revels comes here from Mississippi. Blanche Kelso Bruce. These are two senators from Mississippi. One of them dudes had the seat that was held by Jefferson Davis. Try flipping a seat like that today. Jeff Davis to a black senator living right over there in DuPont Circle. Washington's Black Elite. I forgot who wrote that book. It came out last couple of years ago. All this stuff about these black folks coming here. You got cats coming here like John Langston. John Mercer Langston, a little bit later, who works out of his way out of enslavement in Virginia. Comes to Howard, they won't make him the permanent president after a year and a half. That's too radical. So the trustees like, nah. So he leaves and comes back as a congressman. And the man who I hope everybody gets that picture of, you got there, Deborah, stacked up high, the great Robert Smalls. No, I ain't gonna tell that story. Somebody tell the Robert Smalls story. That's your man. You look, you got him? Yeah, that was in Smithsonian. Tell, yeah. Who knows the name Robert Smalls?
Yeah.
Reconstruction congressman from where?
That's it for Africa World Now Project for this week. I would like to thank you for joining us today and look forward to spending time with you next week. We can be reached through all your regular social media platforms. Email africaworldnowproject@gmail.com or follow us on Twitter at AFWRLDNWPRJ. I'm your host and producer, James Pope. The Africa World Now Project Collective consists of international media journalist, executive producer, and human rights activist Moizu Mutale, Africa World Now Project media correspondent Funda Ngunda, senior research, content contributor, and production director Dr. Tasneem Siddiqui, senior researcher and content contributor and production associate Dr. Josh Myers, associate producer and content contributor Dr. Keisha Khan Perry, technology advisor is Byron Gray of GrayWorks Technology, and creative director is Judah Pope. Africa World Now Project is heard every Wednesday at 7 p.m. on WSNC, NPR affiliate and broadcasting service of Winston-Salem State University. Shows are archived weekly on SoundCloud. Search Africa World Now Project. Until next week, be safe, be peaceful, and above all, be intelligent.